Cows is underwritten in part by Many Rivers Books and Tea. Many Rivers specializes in tools for spiritual practice, tea, and teaware. They're located at 130 South Main Street, Suite 101 in Sebastopol, and can be found online at manyriversbooks.com. They can also be reached by phone at 707-829-8871.
Cows Radio thanks Molesbury's Market for their underwriting support. Established in 1959, they are a family-owned grocer located on Old Redwood Highway in the Larkfield Center. Their website is molesburymarket.com. Molesbury's Market tunes in to the Roots of Rock every Sunday morning at 7 on Cows Community Radio.
May I suggest to you, may I suggest this is the best part of your life? May I suggest this time is blessed for you? This time is blessed and shining almost blinding bright. Just turn your head and you'll begin to see the thousand reasons that were just beyond your sight. The reasons why I suggest to you, why I suggest this is the best part of your life. There is a world that's been addressed to you, addressed to you, intended only for your eyes.
A secret world, a treasure chest to you, of private scenes and brilliant dreams that mesmerize.
A tender lover's smile, a tiny baby's hand, the million stars that fill the turning sky at night. Oh, I suggest, yes, I suggest to you, yes, I suggest this is the best part of your life. There is a hope that's been expressed in you, the hope of seven generations, maybe more. This is the faith that they invest in you. It's that you'll do one better than was done before. Inside you know, inside you understand. Inside you know what's yours to finally set right. And I suggest to you, and I suggest this is the best part of your life. This is a song, comes from the west to you, comes from the west, comes from the slowly setting sun.
This is a song with a request of you, to see how very short the endless days will run.
And when they're gone, and when the dark descends, we'd give anything for one more hour of light. May I suggest this is the best part of your life?
Welcome back. You are listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. And I'm your host, Andrew Lewis. If you're just joining me, know that we're well into the second part of a Shaggy Dog story about some art, a church, a long walk, and life in Southern California in the 1990s. Although today's talk should stand on its own, if you're enjoying it, I do recommend that you go back and listen to the previous episodes, which are available on the Mountain page at KOWS, or you can stream the podcast version from Spotify. Just search for The Mountain and Adoration in a Multitude of Parts. I also encourage you to sign up for the Substack, again at The Mountain and Adoration in a Multitude of Parts, so that you can be apprised of all things mountain. Anyway, I'm glad you're here, because today is going to involve a lot of crazy talk. And when talking crazy, it's comforting to have someone around to listen. Before we jump in, I just have to say that at the time of this episode, our nation and another nation are obliterating the Holy Land in a rain of smoke and fire. Commanding officers, COs, by report, have told the enlisted that they are embarking on a holy war that shall bring about the rapture, and that they themselves shall ignite in the cradle of civilization a pillar of fire. Thousands of innocents, children, mothers, fathers, are in an instant being rendered dead. Some of them didn't even know what hit them. There really could be no unholier act. How do we resurrect ourselves from evil and from sorrow? And is such a thing even possible? The story goes that once there was a king, his enraged heart so angered at women that he vowed to take one a night as his concubine and then at dawn to have her slaughtered. And in this way, he visited a rain of death upon his kingdom. Horrified by the tide of blood, Shahrazad volunteered to become his betrothed, and each night she distracted him with fantastical tales, and each night to withhold the ending so that she would live to see another day. On that first night, the vizier brought to the caliph Shahrazad, and when the king took her to his sleeping chambers and pawed at her flesh, she shed tears and she said to him that she had a little sister. Her name was Dunyazad, and she said that, "I want to say goodbye to her before the night ends. Can you bring her? Can you bring her to your chambers?" And he brought her, and she slept on the ground beside the bed. And when the caliph was finished with his sister, she cleared her throat and she said, "Please, if you are not tired, could you tell us one of your stories, a story to spend the night before I say goodbye to you at dawn?" And Shahrazad said, she asked of the caliph, "May I tell you a story?" And he answered, "Yes." And she said, "Listen." That first night, Shahrazad told the story of the merchant and the genie, and she recounted how a merchant who once lived in great abundance and great wealth, his home filled with women and children and slaves, and his storehouses filled with riches, had journeyed away from his home to another country. And on his return on the road back home, under the great heat of the day, he happened across a garden, an oasis, and there he took shelter in the shade. He rested, he drank the water, he ate of bread and dates, and as he ate the dates, he flung the pits away from him. After he had rested, he rose, he washed and prayed, and he stood on his feet. And as he did so, a genie appeared before him and rose up in his vastness. And he ordered, "Stand that I may kill you as you have killed my son." And the merchant, he said, "What have I done? I have not killed your son. In what way? Who killed your son?" And the genie said, "You did. And the merchant said, I swear to God that I did not. How could I have done it? And the genie replied that as you ate your dates and threw the pits away, one struck my son in the chest and it killed him. And then the genie said that I must take blood for blood. And the merchant pleaded, if I indeed killed your son, then please, it was a mistake. Please forgive me. And the genie, he replied, I must kill the man who killed my son. And he threw the merchant to the ground and he drew his sword. And the sword was lifted high above the merchant and the merchant's claws were wet with tears. And then the merchant said, there is no power and no strength except in God. And he recited to the genie a poem. He said, life has 2 days, peace and menace, one part happiness, then grief. To those who hold the blows of fate against us, ask, does fate help those it does not also test? Do you not see the storms attack only the highest trees? You thought well of the days when they were good and did not care what fortune had in store. The nights were still and tricked you into ease. Yet in the calmest night does trouble come. And again the genie said, I must kill you as you killed my son, even if you weep blood. Must you? Asked the merchant. And the genie said, I must. And he raised his sword to strike. But the morning's light had gained, and it cut Shahrazad short. And the king, he desired to know more. And the sister Dunyazad said, what a strange and lovely story. And Shahrazad replied, what is this beside what I could tell you next? This is nothing. If the king will let me live another day, I will tell you far stranger and more bountiful things. And with that, the caliph, he decided that he would spare Shahrazad until the story's end. He could not wait to hear more. By telling the story, she came to possess the mind of the king, and she herself evaded his possession. Such is the power of stories, what we frame and how we choose to frame them. What story will spare the world a tide of death? What story will we tell such that we can possess our lives once again? I don't know yet, and so we'll carry on with a different set of stories, no more important, but ones that have governed our lives nonetheless. So, last week we were talking gospel, but hold tight, don't go just yet, because remember, we're going crazy. And the crazy starts with the names Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Those names roll off our tongue as easily as the letters L-M-N-O-P. But in the end, they're just stories that some have allowed to govern their lives. But if you want to know the truth, what we know of the author of these 4 books may fall more into the realm of story than into the realm of history and fact. Matthew the Levite, the gatherer of taxes, had been an apostle of Christ. The book attributed to Matthew, however, may or may not have been written by him. It could have been authored by someone else who had simply transcribed the stories told by Matthew. And the first version may or may not have been written in Aramaic before it was later translated into Greek. The book of Matthew, among other things, seems intent on establishing that the life of a man named Yeshua was in fact the fulfillment of prophecy. The book was perhaps written in the year 65 AD, 10 to 15 years after the crucifixion, and before the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. As for the man we know as John Mark, he came later, in the year 200, Clement of Alexandria reported that Mark had observed the Apostle Peter from afar as he made his declarations about the life of Christ to the Gentiles in Rome. Mark was supposedly asked to gather the stories and to compose a narrative of Peter's memories of Christ. But he didn't rely just on Peter's memories. Only 3% of the book is unique to Mark. The rest is a retelling, sometimes verbatim, of what appears in both Matthew and Luke. It too would have been written sometime around the destruction of the temple during the Jewish-Roman War around 70 AD. Then again, many now suppose that Mark's book was first and Matthew came later, drawing from Mark's. And Luke? Luke may or may not have been associated with Paul in Rome during the first century. DNA testing of his relics suggests that he was of Syrian descent. He may have been a Greek Jew. His Greek is articulate and educated. He references and alludes to a range of Greek texts and authors. The book was written perhaps 50 or 80 years after Christ's death. He had not known Christ, but had rather collected stories from other eyewitnesses, though so affected that they were compelled to share what they may have seen and heard. The Gospel of John may have been written by the beloved disciple of Christ, but most likely not. An unlettered fisherman from Galilee would hardly have had sufficient knowledge of the Greek language and Hellenistic philosophy to craft this work. 1,000 years of scholarship and disputation and counter-disputation have been devoted to unpacking the provenance and authenticity of these books. And the work has been complicated further by the fact that we know them almost exclusively, not just through translations, but translations of fragments once marked out on deteriorating and fading parchment. And yet, we rely on this sorry collection of parables and sayings, conflicting emotions and imagined events, as an auger, a guide by which to fashion a moral life. In the end, does it really matter who these men were? Perhaps what matters may not even be the content of the books, but that simply they exist at all. The Gospels, these foretelling, are the window, the only window, through which we can glimpse the life and teachings of a man we now call Christ. Pretty slim pickings, given the momentousness of the event. And if it were not for these four overlapping accounts, we would have nothing at all. In which case, the Son of God quite simply would have ceased to exist. As far as we're concerned, there is no event without the story. In 100 years, the people and the events that I'll tell you about today might no longer be if it were not for these words that I'm speaking to you right now. And so in the chapel, the words of the gospel, the actual parables and depictions of Christ matter less than the existence of the window. In this case, the wheeling cycle of the four forms that give rise to all things. In John Brockley's depiction, the arch of the tetramorph frames the narrative of Christ that fills the back wall. The four beings gaze down with what appears to be a dim, dispassionate sorrow.
Just a little too much to hide. Maybe, baby, everything's gonna turn out fine. Please read the letter, I nailed it to your door. It's crazy how it all turned out. We needed so much more. I put beside the well of many words. My house is full of rings and charms and pretty birds. understand me. My walls came falling down. There's nothing here that's left for you but check with lost and found.
In his driveway in Mission Hills, John applied to all the panels a light base color of tinted paint, and again he sanded them smooth. Another week passed, but now the panels were a light, even camel color. The color was right, but it lacked variation and texture. John opened a pack of thin paper that ruffled easily in the wind. The patterns pulled out into the large sheets crisscrossed with dotted lines and curves. He needed blank oblong pieces. With scissors, he cut by hand whatever blank sections he could find, carefully excising lines and words. These he might use for later. He cut sections of dashed lines and arrows, and sometimes words and obscure symbols, and set them aside. From each sheet, John was able to use perhaps 20%. He preferred the simplicity in Vogue patterns because of the color variance. John would sit and cut paper for hours. He would break to take his dog Sadie for walks in the neighborhood. For months, he sat at a table in his garage cutting pieces of parchment pulled from large boxes containing hundreds of dress patterns. John tried recruiting friends to help. He asked a friend, Gabe, coming off of some drug habit, to sit with him in the garage and cut the paper. He wanted to give Gabe something to do, something that would help him feel useful. He thought it might help for Gabe to have a friend, a place to go, a place to feel safe. I could use your help in cutting this paper, he invited. But Gabe gave up after 15 minutes. He just didn't have the mind for it. A few years later, Gabe would, however, cut his best friend's throat, and after that he would overdose and die. But as for those patterns, their fate would be different. those forlorn and forsaken patterns had been destined for the landfill, but those fluttering sheets would be rescued and they would be elevated and patiently applied to surfaces such that a moment would one day come when the patterns would adorn a chamber intended for the revelation of the body of Christ. John modeled Matthew's face on that of his brother Tom. It's not a Semitic or Mediterranean face, but that of a person from the British Isles. It's the face and head of Ward Cleaver, the face of a staid, practical man, one to announce En Hale, the good tidings of Christ. He came with the wings of an angel. Tom had been the oldest, the stable one, the one who had lived a life that mostly resembled normal. He had learned to lay tile, and then he started a tile company in San Diego that would grow and soon be the primary source for the tile that would outfit foyers and bathrooms and kitchens and the developments that in the 1980s and 1990s had crept over the hills of San Diego like an invading cancer. Tom did well. The next eldest brother, Bob, on the other hand, had struggled. When he was in junior high, family members noticed that he would be wearing these fancy watches. It turned out he'd been meeting people downtown. Bob was into Hollywood, and so later he would take the Greyhound up to LA and try to meet movie stars. Once, his mother, Helen, had to drive up to Los Angeles, the city of angels, because the police had picked Bob up on Santa Monica Boulevard, the Boulevard of St. Monica. Bob was maybe 16 at the time. He ended up living in San Francisco. Then AIDS hit in the mid-80s, but by then he had already started to see things, dark things, and he would hide in his bedroom. John chalked it up to Irish inbreeding. But in the end, schizophrenia was the diagnosis. Bob suffered, they said, from a splitting of the mind. As for John, he had tried to kill himself in fifth grade just before that summer when he met Anna and her sister Jenny. Ulysses S. Grant, our neighborhood elementary school, had been torn down because it wasn't considered earthquake-proof. So all of us from Grant School were ported over to Florence, only 5 blocks distant, but it might as well have been a universe away. It had the feel of a prison yard surrounded by a high chain-link fence. To accommodate the influx of students, they held classes in split shift. Half the kids would awaken at 4 to show up at school by 5:30 in the morning. The remainder would show at 12:30 and stay until 6:30 or 7. It was like going to night school at the age of 8. To make it equitable, we switched schedules halfway through the year. I don't think you could devise a better way to screw up a generation of kids. But for John, it was extreme. Mr. Rathbone was his teacher. John would have panic attacks in school and would just leave Florence during recess. When his panic attacks hit, he only knew that he had to get the hell out of there. He felt he was dying, and he knew only one thing, that he did not want to die in that place. One day he left school and took a bunch of his sister's and brother's meds, and he crawled under the house. And then somebody got the neighbor lady, Julie Cooper, and she found him and took him to the emergency room where they pumped his stomach. That afternoon they took John to a mental institution. Except they didn't have room in the children's ward. And so they put him in the adult unit, which housed the criminally insane. Sometimes in our neighborhood, the murder suspects would escape into the canyons and would hide at night, and the choppers would buzz over the neighborhood, casting their lights in the darkness. That night, they put 8-year-old John in a room with an old man strapped to a bed, and the man would call out. All night long, he called out. "Hey, kid," he said. "Undo these straps. Undo these straps," he would say. Until John could take it no longer, and he got out of his bed. He was so scared, and he went to the nurse's station. "The man is trying to get me to undo his straps," John said. The nurse answered, "If you don't stay in your bed, we're going to put the straps on you." They called the admissions doctor, who came and asked John to sit on his lap.
Life.
They decided John should live with his dad in Pacific Beach, but his dad's second wife was dying of cancer. And so a 9-year-old John would have to take the bus up to his dad's office in La Jolla. One time he missed his downtown connection. Somehow he ended up getting to La Jolla late at night and had to walk up the hill in the dark. Nobody really questioned what happened to him. And why he wasn't trafficked as a 9-year-old boy, I'll never know. He also transferred to Pacific Beach Elementary. One morning he had a panic attack at school and he just walked out at recess and walked to his dad's house and knocked on the door. His dad had an 80-year-old black maid. Her name was Johnny, and Johnny answered the door. But it turned out all these months that she had been wearing a wig and false teeth. But on this morning, alone in the house, she had taken them out. And so she opened the door, bald and toothless. And John, in his anxious panic state, just stood there, paralyzed, before this black skeleton staring at him from the doorway. His mom had signed him up for a swimming class, which was held in the pool in the dungeon basement in the downtown YWCA. John didn't know how to swim, and he entered the dark, tiled room there with the overwhelming smell of chlorine. And the teacher came in, and he was wearing a tight-fitting tracksuit. And he took the top off, and then the bottom. And it turned out he had only one leg, and the other was a prosthetic. And then he popped off the fake leg, and he jumped into the pool. There in the water, he screamed for John to leap in the pool, and John, who was terrified and did not know how to swim, threw himself straight into the water. So badly did he want to get out of his own skin. Johnny didn't have teeth or hair, and the swim teacher who baptized him in the YWCA waters didn't have a leg. And there was the alcoholic father whose wife was dying of cancer, a mentally disabled sister who couldn't remember the catechism, and a brother whose mind had split. But hey, wouldn't yours have too?
Bob goes to church every Sunday that the fish ain't biting. Bob never has to have dinner with the preacher, cause Bob never bothered getting married. He likes to drink a beer or two every now and again. He always had more dogs than he ever had friends. Bob ain't light in the loafers. He might kneel, but he never bends over. Bob takes care of his mama. She's the only one he lets call him Robert. She don't drive anymore, so he takes her to the store and keeps her yard looking just like she wants. Every week at the beauty shop, Bob's mama hears of another woman's made another man disappear. Robert ain't exactly scared of women. He's just got his own way of living. Bob's still got an antenna on a pole. Two channels come in, two more coming go. He used to watch the news, but he don't anymore. Ain't none of it new, it's the same as before. He figures all any of it's any good for is keeping everybody bored till there ain't nobody like Bob anymore. Bob takes care of his mama. She's a mess, but he feels like he oughta. How big a mess today? Ask Bob, he'll say she's a big one and she's gonna be a lotta. He likes to drink a beer or two every now and again. He always had more dogs than he ever had friends. Bob ain't light in the loafers. He might kneel, but he never bends over.
Two decades later, Dawn. John opened a can of matte acrylic gel and thinned it out with water. He laid down a thin 8x11 sheet of parchment onto a panel and brushed it lightly with gel. Once the sample had dried, it had the textured veneer, the color of the interior of the old chapels he had visited in the Italian countryside. The work began. John would patiently layer the pieces of paper onto the board and brush them with gel with a 1-inch horsehair brush. Sometimes the paper would get too saturated and it would tear or wrinkle. He would remove the paper, wipe clean, and begin again. Sometimes a hair would come off the brush and become wetted in the paper. John would pull the sheet off and begin again. Inch by inch, John applied the whispering paper. John brushes the gel across the paper. A brown recluse spider scuttles across a pane of glass. John listens to the house sparrows nesting in the fronds of the Queen Anne palms. On some panels, he lays pieces of parchment that have palimpsests, suggestions of a pattern. These shapes become shadows on the surface, a pair of closed shutters, the opening of a crypt, the outline of a chapel, a sarcophagus. It took 6 months, working 8 to 12 hours a day, just to finish the surface of the panels. After half a year, the unadorned panels were now complete. He signed his and Marcia's names on the back. When it was time to paint Matthew, John knew the face of his brother Tom as well as any face he had ever known. His eyes shadowed, looks down to his right, askance, not looking at you, but watchful over another being, the Corpus Christi ascending. His expression is pacific and concerned, protective and knowing. John had spent evenings executing the preparation sketches of his brother's face, making it as true and real as he possibly could in a palette of white and grays. His face soft, yet chiseled. His dark hair parted, a lock of hair languidly draped over the fore of his head. In the end, he felt that he had his brother Tom. The Apostle Matthew's face was real.
Singing bad, bad love.
You have been listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts, a Shaggy Dog story about San Diego in the 1990s. Today's songs include Me, I Suggest to You by Red Molly, Please Read the Letter by Robert Plant and Alison Krauss, off their wonderful Raising Sand collaboration, Ihoros na Hogu Oro Aile by Duncan Chisholm, Give Me Love by George Harrison, Bob by the Drive-By Truckers, So Lovely, So Sad, Bad Bad Love, sung by Alex Eppard, and we'll be closing the door with Cyndi Lauper's True Color, sung by Carolyn Henning. First and foremost, if you can, please subscribe to The Mountain on Substack. Just Google The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. The link should be in the episode description on KOWS. That's your best way to stay notified when new episodes drop, as well as to receive new kinds of content not available on KOWS. And some current events to add to your calendar. Casey Turner Presents invites you to experience music, dining, drink, and a good time with friends and neighbors. Some great music is coming your way at Hop Monk, Sebastopol's Tavern, and Abbey. If you're lucky, you still might be able to pick up some Big Chicken. This Saturday on March 21st at 8 p.m., Mouths of Babes, again, at the Abbey at the Hop Monk in Sebastopol. As well, get ready to be transported to Dublin through the ages on Saturday, March 28th at 7 p.m. at the Occidental Center for the Arts. Enjoy Irish stories and songs from an all-star ensemble of talented musicians led by the inimitable Eamon Flynn. The Dublin-born singer-songwriter, pianist, got his start with The Commitments, a hit film about an Irish soul band, and has since worked with Elvin Bishop, Maria Moldauer, Michael Franti, Zigaboo Modaliste, The Ray Charles Project, and many others. Ticketing detail can be found by visiting OccidentalCenterForTheArts.org, OccidentalCenterForTheArts.org. The OCA is celebrating its 20th anniversary in 2026. Support local arts in your community. Also, be aware that the California Bluegrass Association has been dedicated to the preservation of bluegrass, gospel, and old-time music since 1975, sponsoring concerts and music camps throughout California. They have been a longtime supporter of KOWS Radio, and we encourage you to get involved in their mission. For more information, they can be reached at 310-207-5114. You can also find out more about them online at cbaweb.org. Ceres is seeking volunteers to aid in growing, cooking, and delivering meals to clients in Sonoma County who are facing serious health challenges. The Ceres Community Project empowers young people as volunteer gardeners and chefs, educating the broader community about the connections between food choices and individual health, the community, and the planet. They partner with healthcare providers and insurers to demonstrate the impact of medically tailored meals to ensure that nutrition is a routine part of healthcare. Shifts are available Monday to Friday in Sebastopol. Visit ceresproject.org. That's C-E-R-E-S project.org. Are you interested in supporting others in our community? The Living Room Life Center is located at 1335 North Dutton Avenue in Santa Rosa. Their mission is to ease adversity and promote stability, dignity, and self-reliance for women and children who are homeless or at risk of homelessness in Sonoma County. The primary emphasis is to aid with housing, food, education, and services for women and their children. For more information about the program, please call 707-579-0138 or visit them online at, all one word, thelivingroomsc.org. That's thelivingroomsc.org. So that brings it to a close, another episode of The Mountain. I look forward to having you join me 2 weeks from now on Friday. And I hope you're enjoying these stories. If you have any feedback or want to chat, feel free to drop me an email at anadoration@gmail.com. And until then, I hope you enjoy yourselves, that you take care of one another, And by all means, if you enjoyed the listen and it makes your world
sad eyes, don't be discouraged. Oh, I realize it's hard to take courage in a world full of people. You can lose sight of it all, and the darkness inside you feel so small, but I see your true colors shining through. I see your true colors, and that's why I love you. So don't be afraid to let them show. Your true colors are beautiful like a rainbow. Show me a smile then, don't be unhappy. I can remember when I last saw you laughing. If this world makes you crazy and you've taken all you can bear,
silent joy of a deep woods commune. Have all sorts of different kinds of names for the motors. Although the motors would be the same.